back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your comic book and pop culture podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I said that so slick. I am the infamous Daph J, aka the Princess of Pontification. That's not a word I would use, but that's what I've been told. Better known as the one and only Madame J, Lady J. Tis I. This week, we have an exciting episode coming to you with some footage and chit chats. With some of yesterday's, today's, and tomorrow's comic book creators on location at the 2018 Toronto Comic Con. The Cave of Solitude's very own Mr. Eric Anthony was there, and he was able to score some cool convos, returning guests, and sometimes hosts Mike Ruth and Shane the Sheriff Heron, who both had some exciting news to share with the projects that they have coming up that literally on the drawing board are there, and they're talking about completing something or the other. I don't know. You got to listen to the podcast. Special shout out to the Shane Heron for releasing issue number 0 of his new comic book, Morris. And I hear that issue number 1 is around the corner. And hosts of the Cave of Solitude and the Fastball Special appear in it? They're gonna be in it. Well, how come I don't have? Am I in? Am I gonna be in it? We don't know. We gotta get to the bottom of this. We need to contact the Shane about this. Of course, we also have the Portuguese Prince Ricky Lima returning and sharing some of his writing and travel exploits. And of course, potato chips were nearby. I think I like this Ricky already. What else do we have? We also have Marvel Comics artist and Toronto's very own Adam Gorham. He was chatting us up about his new Mutant series that has just been released. And although I wasn't there, I got to slid in some real questions of my own that he was able to answer, so stay tuned for that. You know, it'll be great. And from what I've heard through the grapevine, not only is the Adam Gorham a pretty good artist, but he's also a very, very sweet guy. That's what I've been told. Eric Anthony says that it's true. The Shane Heron says that he likes him. So we like nice guys. And do I hear a my spidey senses is tingling. Eric got a chance to talk to the prolific Spider-Man writer, Howard Mackey, which is very exciting, apparently, because Mr. Anthony thinks that the Spidey guy is amazing and spectacular or whatever. And I don't know, I don't understand why he can't get a Batman writer. But anyway, that's what's in store for the week's episode. We hope you guys get some flavor in your ear and enjoy the festivities.
Welcome back, everybody. We are at the Toronto Comic Con, the Comic Prom. We are at the Toronto Comic Con 2018. We are here with one of my favorite guests that isn't named Shane Heron. No, we are with the Portuguese Prince himself.
Portuguese.
The Portuguese Prince himself, the writer of Deep Sea and Black Hole Hunters Club, as well as Happily Ever After, the one and only Ricky Lima. Ricky, how's it going?
It's going good, man. You got some chips, you got some donuts. We're good.
It sounds like a perfect day for you. Where did you get the... Who brought you the chips? You want to shout them out?
Yeah, Shane brought the chips. I mean, they're Lay's chips, which I'm kind of indifferent to, but chips are chips, you know?
$1.79.
Yeah.
What if you could have your pick of potato chips brought to you, like in a dream scenario at the con, what would be the chip of choice?
I think Miss Vicky's is probably the best chip out there. It's got the crunch. It's got the flavor.
Which flavor of Miss Vicky's?
I'd have to go with classic salt and vinegar, but like they have this like cheddar cheese and onion one that's really good too.
What about the black pepper lime?
Black pepper lime's good too, but it like if you eat too much of it, it gets weird, you know.
How about the? So any kettle cooked? How about kettle cooked brand? Is that a good one? It's still kind of Miss Vicky style, but it doesn't have the name.
Yeah, I guess it's like the no-name cheaper version of Miss Vicky's, eh? So I'm into that, too. Also, Old Dutch has these Ariba chips. It's like Doritos, but their own Old Dutch version. They're pretty good, too.
It lives up to the hype?
Yeah, yeah. It got me shouting Ariba.
Awesome. So how's the show going so far for you guys? Is it everything you imagine and more?
I wouldn't say everything I imagine. I could probably be better in that regard, but the show's good, man. Like, going to shows in Toronto is always so good because, like, you know everyone here. Right. And that's good. But then at the same time, like, everyone already has all your stuff. So it really pushes you to, like, make new stuff, too, right, which is, like, always good. I'm always into making new stuff.
So speaking of which, what are you currently working? Is there anything in the fire right now that you're working on?
Well, we got Happily Ever After, the graphic novel, still being worked on. And so that should be out for TCAF, hopefully. If, like, nothing goes wrong, it will be. And then I'm working on... I have, like, a bunch of other ideas that I haven't, like, gotten artists attached to yet, but I'm working on it. And so hopefully those all come out. Those would be sweet. They're all, like, really weird stuff. Like, it's stuff that I realize it's going to be hard to pitch. So I can, like, tell you about it, but I don't even know what it's about, you know?
So, okay, give us an elevator pitch of what you're thinking of.
All right, one is like it's like a post-apocalyptic world, I guess. And he's like a warlord, but he also makes wine. And he's a clone. The clones, it's like a pope kind of situation where one dies, another one's like born. But then one of the clones is like prematurely like made, and then he just messes everything up.
So for a story like that, post-apocalyptic story, what kind of, in your mind, what kind of art are you imagining? Well, whose style would you, for yeah. I guess for somebody listening, like, for them to imagine the style of art?
Well, so this story was inspired, not mainly, but, like, pretty heavily from, like, Flash Gordon. Okay. And I really liked all the outfits that they wore in Flash Gordon.
Right.
So I wanted it to all, like, be very fashionable and, like, very, like, flashy. So the warlord guy is, like, the super fashionista guy who's, like, always looks gorgeous. So I'd really... My initial idea was to make it look like fashion pinups. You know, like, when fashion designers sketch out, like, how people look, you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
And so it's all very angular and very, minimal. That was the first idea I had, but then now I've been seeing, like, other people have been doing, like, really, like, rendered, really cool stuff. Okay. And so I'm thinking maybe switch it. I don't know. My first idea was to have it set on a stage and make the whole thing a play.
Okay.
But then Shane was like, that doesn't make any sense. Why would you set a comic as a play? And I was like, yeah, that's true. Why would I do that?
Shane is the dream killer. He always why would you do that? That just sounds silly.
I'm the dream killer?
Because remember I was telling you I wanted to make a comic that was a play and it was set on stage and everything?
Yeah.
And then you're like, that's stupid. And I was like, yeah.
I said that was stupid?
Yeah.
Sounds pretty good.
What? Now he's saying it's good.
I call people like Shane the Patrick Swayze. They're like the wind. When the wind blows, they change.
Oh, what a guy.
I don't know. I don't think I said that.
Yeah, you said, why would you limit yourself? In a medium like comics, you can't limit yourself, or you shouldn't limit yourself.
Yeah, actually,
so
yeah,
like,
that's
why
right.
Why limit yourself on a stage when you can do whatever you want in a comic?
That's
like,
true, yeah. Yeah, I was right. Don't do that.
You guys are the best. Okay, Shane, I got to ask you, because we talked about it on one of our last episodes. We talked about Morris, and we're at the Toronto Comic Con. So Morris Zero has been released. What has been the response? How are you feeling seeing it on your table in physical form?
It feels pretty good. It's bittersweet for me this weekend because I really wanted to have issue one and zero.
Right.
But I'm happy I have a book, but I wish I had both. But no, it's been pretty good so far. I'm giving copies out to the Kickstarter backers who got the issue zero, but also I've sold a bunch already too, and it just feels good to get Morris out there.
Yeah. So how much further along do you need to go for issue one to be completed?
Oh, I'm just got to color it basically. Like it's like half colored, but it's taken a long time, but it's really, I think it looks really good. I'm like pretty happy with it, which I'm not usually happy with a lot of stuff I do. So like I look back and see, like reread the scenes, and I'm like, I think I did a good job. So I'm gonna be pretty happy when it's finally out though.
Are you going to be having something ready for TCAF yourself? Do you exhibit when you go to TCAF, or do you just go as?
No, I'm not doing TCAF, but Ricky's going to be there. But I'm just going to be like wandering around as a fan.
He's going to be selling books, Jason Clark style, or no?
James Edward Clark style. Yeah, just carry a backpack and sell them to people in front of. No, I'll just put my Morris copies on Ricky's table and you can sell them for me. Hey. Yo, it'll be ready for TCAF, but I'm not tabling at TCAF, so.
I've never actually been to TCAF before.
Oh, you should go. We're going together.
Okay. So you guys, for people who, I know we're at the Toronto Comic Con, we're not supposed to talk about other shows, but.
What?
Whatever, right? This is our show right now.
They just come arrest you right now?
So, for people listening, describe to them exactly what TCAF is and why, if they're a comic book fan, whether it's superheroes or not, why it's a great show to go to.
TCAF is like the best show in the world because it's like everyone who wants to make comics and then they're like a weirdo, it's where it is. Like TCAF has such weird things. It's amazing. And so it's mainly like comic arts. So not necessarily like, you know, superheroes or anything, but more like literary or more nonfiction stuff. There's some fiction stuff, but it's all focused on like pushing the boundaries of comics and like telling different stories in comics and seeing what the medium can do.
Right.
And oftentimes that kind of manifests into like things that are like really weird where you're just like, what is this? But sometimes it's just like really cool stuff too. So
what are some of the things you guys personally have found from TCAF that kind of stuck with you, that you're happy you went, you found this thing, and it kind of either you enjoyed or inspired you?
When I tabled at TCAF like 3 years ago, they sat me beside Andrew McLean, who does Headlopper.
Okay.
And then we became like buds at the show, and he like still remembers me, and like we're like cool and stuff. And that was super awesome because like he's like a huge star now. So it's, I mean, I don't know if like I can call him up and be like, hey man, what's up? But
maybe he can be the one to draw your pulp winemaker post-apocalyptic story.
He's so busy.
I wish.
So how about you, Shane? What have you found from TCAF? Something like books or things?
I mean, there's so many. I have like a stack of like the smaller little zine type stuff. A lot of them, like, I don't even know the names of guys. Like, it's just like, I just go around and find so many cool books. But for a while, there was Becky Cloonan would table at TCAF every year. And she would, for 3 years in a row, she released these like mini comics. I think she collected them all in a book after. One was called like Wolves. One was called The Mire, and I can't remember the last one, but they were just like cool, very unique books, and she would always like number them and sell out. So I got like a bunch of stuff like that. Or I mean, like Jeff Lemire, when he was like, before he blew up, he used to have like all kinds of cool stuff
and
there.
And same with Chip Zdarsky, right?
Yeah, Chip Zdarsky is always there, and Keegan MacLeod, because like a lot of those guys won't do Fan Expo.
Right, right.
So it's cool to see them there at that show. But yeah, I don't know, I love TCAF. It's like my favorite show. It's such a cool, like, there's so much unique stuff that you just won't find. Like a show like this, you're gonna find a lot of like prints of fucking Deadpool and stuff, but I want people's unique little books.
Right.
All kinds of cool stuff.
I remember you showing me one. A person had done a zine style book of daydreaming about conversations with Snoop Dogg.
Yeah.
And he had like, it looked like Charlie Brown on top of Snoopy's house or whatever. Okay, so if you could come up with I know this is not original, but...
Oh, I have two copies of that, actually. I'll give you one.
Okay.
I found I have two copies.
We could do a book club on it.
Yeah.
If you guys could have a comic book written that you guys obviously created, and you were having a conversation with a rapper, which ones would you want to have a conversation with?
Oh, man. Jeez. Open Mike Eagle. I don't know if you know him, but he's like... He's super dope. Or maybe like Bus Driver. Bus Driver's pretty cool.
I never heard of any of those.
Bus Driver? Imaginary Places?
He's a SoundCloud rapper.
Bus Driver? Yeah.
Bus Driver, he did Imaginary Places with the flute, and he's like a really fast rapper. And he was on the Tony Hawk soundtrack, man.
Yeah. Okay, Shake. Can you name... you can name whoever you want, but maybe someone we've heard of before.
I'm trying to
think. Taxi Driver.
Yeah, look at Bus Driver.
Oh, Capadonna. He's a taxi driver. No, I would probably go with Ghostface Killah.
Yeah,
I think, like, yeah, hearing interviews with him, and I think he's so interesting. I would have a lot of questions for him. And I'm just, like, I love his, like, I saw some quote the other day from him, and it was just, like, it was, like, talking about art, and it was just like, if you don't fucking respect art, like, people made that shit, and you gotta respect it. And I was like, yeah, Ghost, you tell them. Like, it wasn't the most articulate thing, but you were like, yeah, he's right, you know? Like, yeah, so I'll say Ghost. I want to say someone else, like I told you, I love Bone Thugs and Harmony. But then, like, I talked to Crazy Bone, and, like, he's just so fucking high. Like, he just gives you, like, yes or no answers. Just like,
yeah,
this is it, fuck this, you know? Like,
yeah.
No, I'm going with Ghostface. He'll give you a good back and forth.
Yeah.
And Action Bronson, too. He's like a chef as well. Yeah, I'd like to, like, eat some of his food. That'd be good.
Him and Ghostface actually had, like, a little dispute, right?
Yeah.
Because
his flow is, like, basically like Ghostface, right?
Yeah, so. I think he actually said that it was on a sports show. He actually said that he's better than Ghostface. And I don't know if you ever seen the response that Ghostface sent him, but I was scared.
Well, Ghostface is great because, like, Martin Shkreli, like, called him out. And then he posted a video, too, of him calling Martin Shkreli out. It's so great. Like, he's just beefing with this, like, this pharmacy CEO. And it's like, what?
That guy's in jail now. He's going to jail.
So what would you ask them if you had the chance? What would you ask Ghostface? You say you got a bunch of questions for him.
I don't know. I feel like we'd do, like, what you do. You just, like, kind of conversation. But I don't know. I'm ill-prepared right now. But I feel like I would come up with a lot of stuff. And I would try not to fanboy out too much, like Jason Clarke does when he interviews his fucking heroes.
How about you, Ricky? What would you ask Bus Driver?
Yeah, I'd ask Bus Driver why no one knows who he is. Like, yo, Bus Driver's good, man.
You gotta play that flute better.
If you want, I'm doing
okay, so you're big in... You have the dream of one day publishing, right? You kind of did a little bit of...
Well, I mean, I'm technically doing it right now, right?
But that's kind of like your big goal.
Yeah, so, like making it my life, I guess, yeah.
Right.
So, hypothetically, if you were... a publisher of a really big, well-established publishing house, let's say it became an Image or a Dark Horse, and you could bring on to your team any artist or writer to work on a book, what would your dream book be? Who would you pair together and love to see them collaborate?
Oh, man. Well, I think art-wise it'd be Ramon Villalobos. He's, like, so good.
Yeah, he is good.
He's almost like a new Frank Quietly, almost.
Okay. No, dude, man, his style's like... It's like Jeff Darrow meets Paul Pope meets like Art Adams. Like, it's like wild, man. It's really cool.
Yeah, he's good. I met him in Seattle recently. He was like super cool. And then, so he'd be doing art, and then who'd write it would be Grant Morrison, just because it'd be so crazy. So,
I saw that you had some Facebook posts and things about going to the Seattle Emerald City Comic Con. What was that like?
It was good, man. It was interesting because the show had a lot of... what I would consider like mid-level comic creators who like they're really good but they just haven't broke through yet, and that's where I feel like we are. I mean, we're like amazing and shit, so no.
I agree.
You know what I mean? So, and it's inspiring to see more people on your level doing well, but then it's also disheartening too because you're like, wow, there's so many people doing this, you know what I mean?
Right.
How do you differentiate yourself? But overall, it was great, man. I loved it. I went there mainly to network, and then I got too shy to talk to some of the bigger guys, so that kind of sucked. But.
So did you go yourself, or had you been invited? Because you were on some panels as well, right?
Yeah, someone was looking for speakers on a panel, so I got in as a speaker. And it was for editorial comics and nonfiction cartooning. So it was all about, you know, like those editorial comics you find in newspapers and stuff, and like biography comics and stuff, so.
How does the environment in Seattle or the Emerald, because I hear a lot of good things about that particular show. What's it like there in comparison to other places you've been to?
Well, I guess because it's in America, like DC and Marvel really show up, and same with like Boom and all the Oni Press, like all the smaller publishers, they like show up. Whereas here in Canada, like you maybe have a Marvel booth, maybe.
Yeah.
And that kind of sucks. But so it's like it's crazy to walk on the exhibit floor and you're just like, holy crap.
Right,
there's, like, things set up like crazy. So that's probably the biggest difference I felt. But Artist Alley feels... Actually, Artist Alley by Repop shows, they're actually run, I feel, a lot better than these Informa shows just because the pro tables are mixed in with everything else.
Okay.
And that feels so much better than having a ring of pros surrounding everyone else. You know what I mean? It just feels kind of shitty. Whereas in Informa, like, you'll have the opportunity to hang out with, you know, a guy who's, like, an established comic creator, and you're just a nobody. Like, at TCAF, when I met Andrew McLean, like, if that was here at Informa show, that would have never happened, right?
So what's the one that Emerald...
Those are Repop shows. And so they do, like, New York Comic Con and stuff in Emerald City.
So in that regard, yeah, I've heard a couple times where... Some artists have said they like going to places where it's not just pros all around. They actually get to sit beside new people that, you know, and just engage and interact with somebody who isn't necessarily a super.
And I noticed Informa is doing this thing now where they have their established layout, and then if you buy a table again, they'll just give you the exact same table. And that sucks, because now you're not meeting anyone new, you know what I mean?
Just kind of in the same spot.
Yeah. So I always want to, like, mix it up and meet new people and, like, do that, but, yeah, we'll see.
So was there anybody that you did get to meet there that you were happy, like, you left and you're like, I made that connection?
Well, yeah, I mean, Ramon Villalobos, man, he was awesome. And Farrell Dalrymple, he was, like, he's great.
Farrell's so good.
He's Farrell Dalrymple for us who don't know.
He's from Portland. He's he did a book for Marvel. That's how I first discovered him, called Omega the Unknown. And it was the first time I saw a Marvel book that had a very, like, indie feel to it.
Yes, then
he started working on Prophet with Brandon Graham and Simon Roy. And then that's how I got into, like, all those guys and, like, discovered. But, yeah, Farrell Dalrymple, so good, man. He does a book called Pop Gun War. I'll show you some of his stuff. It's so good, man. He's really good.
And he's kind of got, like, the way he looks, it's almost like a Jim Morrison kind of thing, because he's just, like, tall and lanky and, like, long hair, and he's just super cool. He's a good guy.
Great. So, okay, another question for you guys, randomly. If you, from your peers, amongst your peer group, what's a book that you want other people to read that your peers have made?
That our peers have made?
Yeah. In your peer group or stuff that you've read that you want other people to go and jump on?
Well, I mean, Becca Gorefield, she does a book called Starglazer, and it's like this erotic space adventure. And it's so good. What's good about it, though, is it's like the sex makes sense. Like, it is part of the story.
Right.
Because these aliens need this guy's seed to, like, further their race or whatever. So, like, they need to extract it somehow, so they fucking have sex with this guy. And it's great. And you're reading it, and the way she draws, like, bodies is, like, they're not, like, super muscular. They're, like, kind of plump. And it's great. I love it. Everything she does is so good.
It feels real.
Yeah,
it's not gratuitous for the sake of
it. It is pretty gratuitous, but at the same time, you're like, yo, I'm into this. You know what I mean?
So we know what Ricky reads at night. How about you, Shane?
I just noticed you always get, like, giggly and nervous when people talk about sex on your show.
Well, when the first time you heard it was when my wife was pretending to be a man and imagining what that would be like, so it made me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, but, like, the last podcast, right, where she was talking about, like, I know, she talked about sex.
Yeah.
And then you got all, like, weird and, like, giggly and, like,
yeah, some people
nervous.
Are uncomfortable with it. Why
are you calling them out, man? It's so funny. Then you start talking about sex and you got all giggly again.
It comes down to some...
I like calling people out on stuff. It's
you know
funny.
What? It is funny, but you also know that, I know some of the people who are going to listen to this.
Yeah.
And I just imagine their reaction, so I start laughing.
My mom listens to this.
My mom doesn't.
That was so funny, too, because I did Aaron Broberman's podcast, and he wanted me to tell the story that I was like, I wouldn't want my dad hearing me tell this story. But then he's like, they're not going to listen to this. And I was like, you're right. My dad has no idea what a podcast is. Like, there's no way in hell he would ever hear this. I was like, whatever.
Right.
Anyways, what's the question?
So out of your peers, stuff that they're creating, what's something that you really want to back or other people to check out because you're a big fan of it?
There's so many good ones. I mean, I love... like, Adam Gorham's in the New Mutants stuff. Anything by Adam Gorham, he's, like, my favorite artist. Fred Kennedy's Fourth Planet book with Miko is so good. Jay Fosgate, just, I couldn't get a copy. He sold out of his new Bodhi Troll book from Boom. He only had, like, 20 copies. He sold them all yesterday. And then Sean Daly's Samurai Grandpa is so good.
Yeah, I bought that one myself.
A beautiful book. Yeah, I don't know. They're, like, honestly, there's so many talented people that are around, like, friends with us. So, yeah, any of those books, really, I don't know.
Black Hole Hunters Club.
Definitely Black Hole Hunters Club. So, Ricky, I got a question for you, because I read Deep Sea recently. I enjoyed it. And I remember you describing a couple things to me about how David Bishop did the art using pens. And I understood that the red and the blues, but then there was something about the yellow, and I kept trying to figure out what the yellow was. And so I said, I think Ricky told me, but I got to go and ask him when I see him. What did the yellow represent?
I don't even know, man. We're just like, yo, we need to add in a new color. So we added the I'm sure there's, because, like,
issues here. I don't have issues
like, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's, like, a new element in the book that wasn't in the original 8-page story.
Right.
So I guess we wanted to, like, represent that and, like, the mysteriousness of that new element to it. So
I don't want to spoil the book, but Is there a way for you to describe to us what it was that inspired the story for you? Because you said that you had had it for a while, and then you pitched it to Dave, and he jumped on it. So what was it that inspired it?
Yeah, like the 8 pages was inspired mainly just by the pen drawings that he did, and the colors of blue and red, and we're like all blood and water. But then the further story was inspired by that, the 8-page story, when the monster is like, well, if you had a kid, what would you have done? And then, so it's like, okay, well, what would she do? So then the graphic novel just explores that.
Okay, give us a quick synopsis of what the book is basically about. Because I think we're talking about, like, we know, but we haven't explained what exactly the premise is.
I tell people it's about a diver who discovers a secret underwater, and the secret starts to tear the city apart, and then she's caught in between the government trying to keep the secret a secret, and the secret getting out. That's kind of like how I describe it, yeah.
And I love the concept of sludge, of what, how it's being used and misused, and how it's, everybody's dependent on it. Where did that idea come from, and how'd you come up with the name sludge?
I don't even know. I don't know. It was kind of like I was thinking...
You wrote it, right?
Yeah, I was thinking of ways that we could use the chemical more. And then I was thinking, I guess, of people like huffing gas. Okay. Like, there's a lot of people who just, like, use gas as a drug. So I was like, okay, what about that? And I was like, all right, well, I don't want them, like, injecting it into themselves or whatever. So then they just kind of, like, rub it on their body. Deep sea, bro.
We went from talking about sex to hard drugs.
Yeah.
Hey, what's up?
So, yeah. So then it was all about sex and penetration. And, like,
draw something, too?
So if people want to pick up these books, because I would highly recommend Deep Sea and Black Hole Hunters, where can they pick it up other than being at the Comic-Con?
See, that's a big question. Nowhere, really. They can't really get it anywhere. So I should open up an online store that people could buy it at, but I haven't yet.
Stadium Comics, will they carry any of it for you?
I mean, I could put them there, but I haven't.
You should try.
It's just such a hassle having books in a store, and you have to go and be like, oh, did you sell a book? And they're like, no. And you're like, oh, my God.
No, we're going to get them in stores.
And how about for Morris? If people want to pick up Morris or Black Hole Hunters Club, is there a place that they could pick it up?
Well, the best place is the online store. Like, I don't have Morris because I just launched it this weekend, but I'll have it in my online store. We have a Black Hole Hunters Club online store. And that's linked on the Facebook group. But Morris will be, a bunch of retailers bought my package of, like, the Morris retail package, so a lot of them will have it. Like, we're going to have it in Paradise. Carlos is going to buy some off me for Gotham, and I don't know, where else? Stadium Comics, Brampton.
See, there you go, Stadium Comics.
Yeah, where Ricky works. And
yeah, why isn't Deep Sea at Stadium? I don't know. I can't believe
it's not there. No, I thought our books are there. Yeah, I don't know. It'd probably be at the Snail, too, and Beguiling. I haven't talked to them yet, but they usually do that type of thing. And then even Trent up in Sarnia. What's his store called? Future Pastimes?
I think so.
It'll be available in Sarnia if you want.
And that's where both of you, if you could, retire and live your dream life. It would be Sarnia.
I called him out on that.
Shane called me out on that, and I was like, that's true, because Shane did say that. And then when I said it on your podcast, I was like, yo, Shane already said this. But I just kept going with it, and I feel kind of bad, so I apologize to everyone involved.
You can, like, be next door to me in Sarnia when we retire, but you did steal my answer.
I like being original, and that wasn't original. I felt weird about it.
I think bus driver is a pretty original answer.
So we always do the Sarnia Comic-Con. We've done it for, like, last 4 years, and we always do great there. The guys who run it are amazing, like, just super cool dudes. And, like, every time we're out there, we're like, I kind of like Sarnia. Like, it would be a nice place to retire. And I think I said that last year, and Ricky was like, noted.
Pretty much, man.
That's great, guys.
I'm like, you know that younger brother who just says everything that the older brother says, even if he, like, doesn't realize what he's saying?
Well, when you're older brother, Shane Heron, why not, right?
Exactly.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for your time. I hope you have a great rest of the show. And Ricky, next time we get together, we'll have a big platter of nachos, I promise.
Yeah. Shane told me you guys had nachos for, like, your 100th or whatever.
That's right.
And I was like, shit, I would
always eat good when I get on these shows.
Oh, man, I'm jealous.
I brought these guys cheesecake. I brought them pie.
We ate pretty good when we did our episode, too.
We did.
Right? So, there you go. All right, guys. Take care. Thank you so much. We are back at the Toronto Comic Con 2018. Now, our next guest, you have seen his artwork grace the pages of such titles as Violent from Image Comics, Dead Drop from Valiant Comics. He's also hung out with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in the sewers of New York City. And recently, he's penciled the series of Rocket Raccoon and now the recent relaunch of Marvel's New Mutants. We are talking to none other than local Toronto legend and now Marvel comic superstar, Adam Gorham. Adam, how are you?
Thank you. That was quite the introduction. I'm feeling really good right now about myself.
I always try to come up with this long introduction, just praising the guests so that they don't know how to handle the love that they're going to get.
I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for taking some time out of your busy day. Your table's got good traffic. Everyone's coming to see you. How does it feel to be, you know, at this stage of your career?
Honestly, it feels very good. I always, you know, like I can't help but look back. I've been doing this for about 10 years now, from starting out with some indie stuff and then eventually getting into, like, you know, mainstream published stuff. And, you know, it's easy. Like, when you're in the middle of it, just you're always worried about the next thing, what's the next job going to be, and so on. But I've reached a point where, like, you know, even though I still feel like I'm in that hustle, I can at least look back and appreciate how far I've come and just feel grateful for where I currently am. So, and that's a nice feeling, and that's where I'm currently at, and I'm not jaded yet, so I feel good.
That's good. And talking to people who, like, I have some friends, I say, who do you think I should talk to? What's a good creator to interview? And everybody will always bring up your name, and not because your work is great alone. They say he's one of the nicest guys that you can talk to. So along with the work being great, to have the reputation of being, you know, one of the nice guys is always a good thing to have under your belt as well.
That's really nice to hear. Yeah, I don't know what to say to that other than that it makes me feel pretty nice.
All right, so let's take it back to the start. Obviously, you love comic books. You wanted to do it as a career. Mm-hmm. How old were you when you picked up your first comic book? What was it, and what made you fall in love with it?
Oh, geez.
If you can remember that far.
Well, I couldn't tell you the very first comic I ever picked up, but certainly the first book that ever made a lasting impression on me was a graphic novel of Batman the Cult.
Yeah,
and so this was at a time where our local mall had like a newspaper stand and cigar shop that had begun carrying comics because they were, like, you know, there was the comic bubble at the time. They were the hot thing, so they were ordering comics and had quite a selection there. And for whatever reason, my dad decided to buy me, like, this Batman graphic novel. Obviously, didn't crack it open to look at whether or not it was suitable for me. But, you know, I looked at it, and it was unlike anything I had seen. You know, you got Bernie Wrightson's art, which is, like, dark and gothic. But just the subject matter itself was, like, Batman in a way that I had never seen before. Like, I had the animated cartoon, and I had seen pretty, like, you know, clean stuff from the 80s and early 90s, but this was a whole other thing. You know, there was like blood, gore, violence, more just really morbid stuff in this book. And so, you know, that just turned a light on for me, just in the way that Bernie Wrightson inked, and just like the use of black and how emotive everything was. And so I cherished that book for a long, long time. So that was probably like, I didn't look at that book thinking like I had to make comics, but as much as like a bat left an impression on Bruce Wayne,
right,
this book left sort of a dark impression on me of like the things that good art and storytelling can do. So,
right.
And I, as far as like what got me into making comics, like that wouldn't have been until much later when I got back into comics after adolescence. So, like, you know, artists like Alex Ross or Frank Quitely and Grant Morrison's run on New X-Men, those were things that I really ate up when I got back into comics in the early 2000s. And I started to, like, you know, I was already, like, pretty artistically inclined at that point and thought, like, I think I'd like to do this for real.
Right. I remember the advertisement. Speaking of the cult, I remember them in the single-issue magazines. I just remember Batman being beated up. The emblem was ripped off of his chest.
Yeah.
It wasn't in graphic novel form yet. It was still, I think, like that Baxter edition with single... It was the deluxe kind of format of a 4-issue miniseries, and I didn't know where you could find it, but that image that you were describing of seeing something so dark happen to Batman in a comic book, it's like, is this possible? Because I always had the Adam West impression of,
yeah,
that's Batman's universe, so it did definitely left a mark in my mind too. So what were some of the other books when you were either young or when you did get back into comics that were your favorites? Who were some of your favorite? You mentioned Frank Quietly.
Yeah.
Who are some of your favorite artists that, you know, maybe influenced your style or really inspired you?
It's really it's all over the place. Like, so I was never like an avid collector. Like, I would, you know, whenever I would have an allowance, I would buy things that I could, right? Growing up, that is. So I had but I knew in the building I grew up in, there was an older boy who had quite a collection, and he'd let me look at stuff. So I learned a lot about specifically the X-Men in the 90s, through this older boy's collection. He kind of gave me an education, I guess. So I followed along with Executioner's Song and Age of Apocalypse and all those things just by hanging out at his place. And I remember at the time, the Wolverine, the Weapon X miniseries from Age of Apocalypse, which I believe was drawn by Adam Kubert. Certainly a Kubert, but I think Adam. Just his, the way he drew and his storytelling in that. It was just a really solid action book, and I liked that a lot. When I started collecting in the early 2000s and just really getting back into it, already said, Quietly's new X-Men stuff, but everything from, the X-Men era, I was right into, Cable as kind of a freedom fighter in Africa. That run, I thought was really cool, that Igor Cordy drew, and Ultimate X-Men I was right into, and I'm trying to think of other stuff, but certainly, those books were, really awesome. And then I would follow Quietly over to All-Star Superman years later when he would do that. And there's tons of other things that I'm not thinking of, but you just sort of, I was absorbing a lot and just into everything, Lionel Yu, Lionel Yu stuff. He did some Wolverine stuff, and
did Superman Birthright, I think.
He did Superman Birthright, and he was a phenomenal talent that I was really struck by, and I could go on and on. So there was a whole bunch of stuff that I absorbed.
So you said that in the early 2000s you kind of got back into comics with the Grant Morrison X-Men. So during the time that you weren't into comics, what kind of stuff did you enjoy? Probably music. For me, I was really into music in high school and all those other things, because comics were, kind of childish or too expensive. What were you into?
I remember that, when I was in grade school. When I was in grade, I remember being in fourth grade and kind of figuring out I should probably stop bringing action figures to school. people thought that, the other kids in my class were this kid's freaking weird. Because I'd, bring, just figures of mine and would play with them at recess, and it sort of dawned on me that just wasn't done anymore, I guess. So I let pieces of my childhood go around fourth and fifth grade. And at that point, I don't know. I think at that age, you start to worry what other kids think about you. You start to worry about what's cool. And, of course, kids don't know what's cool. No. They're just sort of I remember I got into music videos. I'd going home and watching Much Music and watching music videos without actually, liking music all that much. I thought, oh, yeah, I'm really into music. But I was really just watching, the top 20, top 40. Whatever some fucking, record exec was deciding people should be listening to.
Yeah.
So I didn't have a music vocabulary. I was just listening to whatever was popular and what my friends were listening to, because at that age you just want to be a normal kid.
Right. You want to be in the know.
Yeah. So probably more than anything, it was movies that I was really into. I loved going to the movie theater. In Mississauga, we had the Coliseum. So I would try to go to the movie theaters as often as possible when it was summertime. And so movies were definitely my bag. And I don't think the 90s were a particularly great time for cinema.
No.
There's a lot of things that...
It was fun, but you look back and it doesn't age well.
No, there's a lot of stuff that does not hold up. But I remember one of my first pure movie-going experiences was going to see Out of Sight in theaters, which is an Elmore Leonard adaptation by Steven Soderbergh, starring George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez. And it, yeah, and so, like, that was, like, my first, like, it felt like that's this is my first film, you know? Like, I had decided to go see it myself, and it wasn't, like, you know, it wasn't Will Smith and Men in Black. Like, it wasn't, like, easy popcorn entertainment. And it felt like, I'm going to go see a movie, like, a film, and I felt really sophisticated about it. And at that point, I considered myself a movie-goer, like a film connoisseur type thing. But yeah, so I guess growing up, movies were really more, it's funny to think, like, I wasn't into comics, I was into movies. And nowadays, like, movies are comics, basically.
Right, right. So do you have a favorite movie from that time where you were, you know, considering yourself a film goer? What stands out to you that's, like, in your top three movies?
Gosh, as I said, Out of Sight. I remember a friend of mine, I'd go over to his house because he had HBO. And I remember going over to his place, being on the TV, and catching, like, Jackie Brown around when it was, like, around the beginning of the movie, and then just being hooked. And I think at the time, like, people, you know, they were hating on Jackie Brown. Like, Tarantino hadn't made, it had been a few years since he had made a movie since Pulp Fiction, I think, and he made Jackie Brown, and it just wasn't, I think, what people wanted from him, but it was, probably his best movie, certainly, like, the best Elmore Leonard adaptation, as far as I'm concerned. And what was cool about Jackie Brown and Out of Sight was that Michael Keaton played the same role in both movies. Ray Nicolette, I think in one he was FBI, and in the other he was an ATF agent.
Oh, that's
but it, there was, like, it, you kind of had, it was one of the first, like, shared movie cinematic universe experiences that I ever had, because, wait, Michael Keaton, formerly Batman, is, like, playing the same agent in both these cool crime movies? That's awesome. And, of course, like, you read Elmore Leonard's books, and, like, he has a lot of characters appear in other novels. So that was, like, not new for the, you know, for the hardcore Elmore Leonard reader, but it was cool to see that happen in film.
Yeah, I think there's something about continuity that appeals to everybody. They may not realize it, but we all like those things that connect each other.
Yeah.
There's, like, something fulfilling about it.
Well, at that time, like, it felt more like an Easter egg than anything else. Like, you know, like, I had been paying attention in one movie and caught this in another.
Yeah.
And it felt like, it felt rewarding to spot it, like, as if, like, the filmmakers were, like, winking at me, like...
Yeah, yeah.
And,
You're in the know, like, you got a secret that maybe other people didn't pay attention to.
Yeah, exactly, and it was something that you could, like, mention to other people at parties or whatever the fuck, but...
But now it's everybody goes to the theater, and they're not even watching the movie as much as they're looking for the Easter egg, it seems, right? Especially with the Marvel Universe, or, oh, did you see that thing? That's a reference to such and such. So now it's almost overdone, where you're not enjoying the film anymore.
Yeah, they've set a new precedent for that. And I'm not at the point where, like, it ruins things for me. But certainly when you see things done just because they want to get that across, like, you know, like, I'm a story first kind of fellow, and so when something is done just to get, like, a certain reaction, like, it does, I can gloss over it, but I can see down the road it becoming, like, more of a problem.
Yeah.
So you brought up X-Men, how it had left an impression on you as a kid reading it, Age of Apocalypse and the quietly Grant Morrison. Now you're working in the X-Men universe.
Yeah.
What's that like for you?
It's a trip, man. I'm really excited about it. I'm really, like, it does feel like a milestone for me personally, and I couldn't be more happy about it. Every production on a comic book is its own circus, and so, you know, every job has its highs and lows, and it is, like, there are days where, like, it is work, but it's the kind of work that I've, like, strived a long time to have, so... You know, through it all, I'm really happy, and I'm feeling really positive about things right now, and, you know, that'll last for so long, but I, you know, like, it's just something that I can't quite put into words. Like, I'm really happy with how things are going, and I want to make this the best book that I can, and I think, like, as release for the first issue approached, I did start to get, like, jitters and nerves, just because, like, you know, X-fans can be pretty vocal about what they like, or more so, like, what they don't like. So I was worried about, because I'm making specific choices with some of the characters, and this is a story that is handling characters who, you know, people, like fans of these characters, they want certain things addressed, or they're hoping this happens, and so you want to make people happy, but at the same time, you want to do something that's cool for yourself, and so, you know, I started to get nervous about that, but so far, everything's been really positive, and I think people are, like, you know, picking up the book in good faith and giving us a fair shake, so that's exciting for me, and, you know, when the second issue drops, I'm hoping people like that even more, and so I'm positive.
That's great. And as well, there's the New Mutants movie coming out this year, right? Correct?
Yeah, next year.
Oh, okay, next year. So with the comic, is there a certain editorial mandate that it's got to sort of reflect what people might experience at the movie? And is that helping you creatively, knowing the direction you got to take it? Or is it sometimes stifling, if at all, if that's the case?
So, no, there's, like, you know, nobody's making books to think, like, let's make this just like the movie. I know that's one of the perceptions with, like, one of the things I've noticed with this book coming out is that it seems, in every review that I've read or comment that I've made, it's almost as if they're eye-rolling, like, well, yeah, of course this book's coming out.
Yeah.
Because there's a movie, right? And I find that dismissive of the book, and, like, I also don't see what the problem with that is, like, to have that kind of synchronicity. And it's not like we're adapting the movie. Like, this is its own thing. And, you know, like, if there is, like, you know, like, they always say strike while the iron is hot. So if there is that interest there, then, like, why not try to capitalize on it? And, you know, these are characters that fans had wanted anyway. And so, you know, I think it would actually be weirder to have a New Mutants movie and then not have a book out. And
exactly.
You'd have people see that movie and they'd be like, damn, man, like, I could really go for a comic right now that had those characters. Isn't it weird that they haven't done that?
Yeah.
So I think that there would be, like, more criticism. So when we, you know, when the book was coming out and people are like, well, of course there's going to be this book because this movie. Like,
cynics, they're not even critics anymore. They're just cynical, right?
Well, and, you know, like, I don't want to, like, be mean to anybody, but I don't see how one cheapens the other. And yeah. I think you can have separate experiences or enjoy them both. Anyway, so that's the one weird thing out of this that I've noticed, but it hasn't been terrible. It hasn't detracted anything from me. And so with the movie being pushed back, I was almost relieved because now, like, people get to look at the book on its own merits. And I think we have some really fun stuff coming down the pipe with this. So hopefully that, like, the interest that the movie sparked remains, but we're now not competing in anybody's minds for, you know, like, that attention or whatever. So people are going to read the book just for the book itself, and I think that's a great thing.
So is it going to be a finite story, or is it going to be an ongoing?
No, that was another thing, too, is that since it was a miniseries, I think I've noticed this habit of, like, kind of dismissing miniseries as being inconsequential because there's only so much you can do, or you know, wanting to do something for the sake of it. And this is going to affect continuity. It's of consequence, and you know, we're taking this to a place where, you know, there's things that will need to be addressed, whether or not it's Matt and I addressing them, and I'd love for it to be Matt and I addressing them down the road. And it isn't anything, you know, there's no real sucker punches or, like, cheap tricks or anything. It's just it's a really fun story with some, like, I think unexpected turns. And so yeah, it's a mini, but it's in continuity and it's of consequence.
It's going to count.
It's going to count.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that everyone's always concerned nowadays with, the constant, like, renumbering, rebooting. Even with, like, for me, I read a lot of New 52 and then they change things and it's like, well, it feels like these books don't even count anymore. So with miniseries, I guess everyone's a little trepidatious about that, but it's good to know that this is something to read if you're an X fan.
For sure. And, you know, like, maybe it's because of the position I'm currently in and working for a publisher, but the guff about it's a new number one, like, I'm kind of over it. I kind of feel like if you're complaining that something's being renumbered, like, I don't know, I'm sympathizing less and less just because, like, you know, we're not, you know, it's not like we're wiping away continuity with a number. So, like, I'm starting to roll my eyes over when people go, like, oh, it's just a new number one, like that, you know, like, like they're being like stabbed with a fork or something yeah. like that, you know? And it's sort of like, I maybe it's just because I know people are only ever trying to put out the best comics possible, and they want people to be like enjoying comics. They want people to have a great experience. And everybody I've met, whoever makes a comic, is going in with like the best intentions. And they want to do something, you know, everybody wants to do something bold, they want to do something new, they want to do something that's going to make people happy. And those can be tricky things to balance, yeah. for sure. But nobody ever wants to make a comic that's like going to be a bummer for folks. Yeah. So, you know, to be put off by something like a number change, like there was a time where I feel like, yeah, I get that, but now
that's how it is.
Maybe it's just because, maybe it's just becoming more normalized for me, I don't know. But like I fail to see why that's a big deal.
It's also sometimes good. It could be frustrating if you're the old school mentality, but it's also good places for people to jump on and be like, okay, here's that new spot to jump on and get this story, and I know where I'm at.
Yeah, I mean, the thing of it is that like when I got back into comics, like things like a new number one or like new starting points were havens for me, because it's like, okay, great, here's my entry point.
Right.
Going back to how I like loved New X-Men, I mean, that was just, I believe they hyped it up, but it wasn't a new number one. It was like issue 114.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, it's like, you got to be here for issue 114 and so on. So like that wasn't the case, but they did hype it up as like a brand new beginning. And so I can see how you sort of like, to eat my own words here, I guess, but like that is an example of how like you don't need a renumbering to generate excitement. They were just excited about like this new creative team and new direction, but it was still, I guess, you know, it was still on the same path, so to speak.
It was beneficial for you.
I flip flopped in real time there. That's great. But now I guess, yeah, maybe it's because of years of like renumbering. I'm now just like used to it, and it's like, hey, it's gonna happen. Just get comfortable with it.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah.
So before we wrap up, I got some listener questions. Is that cool?
Okay. Yeah, it's totally cool.
All right. So my co-host of the show is also my wife, and she comes up with some great questions that a lot of times the fans would think we shouldn't ask that, but I think they're great questions.
Sure.
So she said, what rituals do you have when you're about to get into your work? Do you say a prayer? Do you eat a cupcake? Or what do you do to get into your work?
So my work days are I mostly work from 9 to 5. I have 2 children, and so I can't really get into work until after I've dropped them off at school.
Okay.
And I have until I pick them up from daycare and after school programs. So I drop them off, I come back home. I usually finish the pot of coffee that I made and wasn't able to touch. I'll have a light breakfast, and you know, like I might stretch or walk around, play with my dog a little bit. And then I need some time to kind of, you know, just like, okay, what's my objective today? What am I going to do? And formulate a game plan. But I don't have anything too specific other than that. Like, it's pretty generic.
Right on. And what kind of dog do you have?
I have a Brittany Spaniel, and her name is Harlow.
That's the best riding, or the partner to have with you, right? Because they're just by your side.
Harlow, I think, she's over spending time with me in my office. I'm not very interesting. Like, I talk to her and stuff and all.
Yeah.
But she, she's much more interested in what's going on out of our living room window. So,
right. Of course, the neighborhood watch.
Exactly.
How excited, or do your kids realize how cool it is that their dad is the guy who gets to draw Guardians of the Galaxy characters or X-Men?
My oldest daughter, who's 8, she now gets it. There was a time where she kind of didn't, and like I, you know, she would visit these conventions since she was young, but she now gets it. She now thinks it's cool, but she's very subdued about it. You know what I mean? Like, she will admit, yeah, it's pretty cool, but like, just no matter what she says or how low key she is about it, like, she will. Any comics that I make, she reads. She brings to her room without me knowing. Like, I found copies of The Violent in her nightstand that she just decided, she wanted to read because I had made them.
Right.
So, like, you know, I know that she thinks it's really awesome whether or not she says it, and that means the world to me.
And one day it's going to definitely hit them when they see that dad's on getting to watch the New Mutants before everybody else gets to.
I doubt that.
Okay, another question from my wife, Daph J. When you're drawing Rocket Raccoon, do you hear Bradley Cooper's voice or do you hear someone else?
That's a really rad question. I certainly didn't hear Bradley Cooper's voice. It was probably just like a voice of my own. I would say that it would be kind of like a version of my own voice. And I'm not going to do an impression. But no, I try not to think of the actors in the films when I'm drawing these characters, and so but certainly Scrappy, like a rougher kind of voice.
Right. So you have a voice that you actually are able to do when you're putting it together to get into that emotion of it.
Yes.
Can we get it one day? Maybe not here, but one day we will get that voice as maybe a show opener.
Nope.
Okay. Being a comic book artist, do people take advantage of you like they would if you were, let's say, a massage therapist or a plumber? They say, can you just draw this picture for my kid, or can you do a X-Men for me?
I've never had really bad experiences that way, but I like to do little drawings for children at shows, and I like to do that because I want it to be, like, you know, these are fun events. I remember, like, I would have loved to have come to comic conventions when I was a kid. It would have been a really big deal. And so I believe in making these events special for children, and if a little drawing that takes 5-10 minutes of my time can do that, then that's terrific. But you always, like, you know, like, you do that in small doses, I guess. But I've never had anybody where I've really felt has taken advantage of me. Everybody's pretty respectful, and I feel pretty lucky in that regard. But I, as far as, like, you know, I don't mind doing something special for the kids who, you know, because that's like you want to seed that in future fans.
They'll come back. They'll remember this guy was so nice to me when I was a kid, and I'm a fan forever.
Well, I mean, regardless of whether it's for me specifically, but just like to come away feeling good about comics and shows, and to forge a love of this medium.
Yeah. Okay, this is the last one. I'll apologize ahead of time because it was sent in from a friend. They said that now that you're a Marvel artist, how come you're big leaguing and ditching your friends Ricky Lima and Fred Kennedy? I'll let you guess who sent that in.
Right on. Because I can, I guess. I'll talk to you later, Shane.
There you go. You knew it. I didn't even have to give you the wink. All right, thanks so much, Adam. I really appreciate you coming on the show and giving us so much of your time. I hope you have a great rest of the day, and we're looking forward to all the stuff that you're going to be creating in the future.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you.
So now, our next guest on the show, as I learned yesterday at one of the panels that we had in the afternoon, he is known as the evil, yet always handsome, and legendary Howard Mackey. Welcome to the show, Howard.
Thank you, Eric. I appreciate you having me.
So I saw a Facebook post recently that you had saying that you find it quite funny that you're now known as the legendary. A lot of creators can take that as a compliment, but sometimes they'll be like, really? Legendary? Why do you find it funny?
Well, I don't consider myself legendary at all. I've been doing this for a while, but there's an expression that or a phrase I've heard used by brave men who have served in wars, when they talk about when somebody calls them a hero, and they say, I'm not a hero, but I've served with heroes. And that's how I feel about my career, not comparing it to what soldiers do at all, but I don't consider myself a legend, but I've certainly worked with quite a few legends, and it's hard for me to accept myself as a legend. I've been around for a while, I'm experienced, certainly, but not a legend.
Well, to consider how long you've lasted in the business and the books you've worked on, the people you've worked with, mm-hmm. It's safe to say you're in rarefied air, correct?
Oh, absolutely, and I take it as a compliment, certainly. And, you know, given the company I kept on that panel yesterday, I was very honored. It's semantics. It's not false humility at all. It's just I'm a writer who does a job that is, and I'm really fortunate that it's fun and I get paid to do it. So anything beyond that, people can call me what they wish. I can't let it go to my head.
Fair enough. It's always good to stay humble. So the era that you were talking about, it's one of my favorite personal eras of comics because it was when I was throughout my life, but it's also that time where people working on the comics were really big fans of it themselves. So what were some of the things that you enjoyed growing up? Were you a comic book fan growing up yourself?
Oh, yes. Well, I always, again, this is semantics. I never thought of myself as a fan, but I was a comic book reader.
Right, right.
And I honestly have to say, I was I worked with a lot of people who were absolutely hardcore fans. I just loved to read comics. I loved everything about it. I taught myself to read through comic books. Yeah. I have older sisters. They used to buy me comics, and I wanted to know what was going on. And it started out with things like Archie Comics, because they were interested in those. Yeah. But then they started getting me Batman, Superman, Spider-Man comics. And I just loved it. And I read comics for many years. And then I stopped for a while.
Everyone has that story. Yeah, we stop in high school because
boys discovered girls and music, exactly. And then I was very fortunate in that a good friend of mine, and I think I mentioned it at the panel yesterday, good friend of mine was Mike Carlin, who later on went on to, he was an editor at Marvel, became an editor at DC, was editor-in-chief at DC, and he's still working for Warner, I don't know his exact title, but it's,
I think he's in the animation,
right. I think creative director or something. And Mike and I grew up together. Yes, and I had a job that at one point in my mid-20s that I was not a big fan of, and he was tired of my whining about it. So he had been an assistant editor at that point, and he got a promotion, and he said, you know, let's stop whining. And because he had been working in Marvel, he had been giving me comic books, so I got caught up on the continuity. He said, you know the continuity, you know comic books, you're not stupid, why don't you apply for the job? So I did, and I got a job at Marvel as an assistant editor. And that was how it all started for me.
So at the time, having not, let's say, written anything or published anything, but you had a friend who was an editor. When you applied for that job, what were the qualifications they were looking for? Was it the fact that you knew the continuity well?
No. I'll tell you honestly what I believe you needed to get hired as an assistant editor there. You needed to be able to get along with the person you were working for, because we shared a very small office space together. It was about 10 by 10. And so you were going to spend a lot of time with the person you were hiring. So you needed to make sure that you guys would get along. And you needed to be able to follow directions and use your finger to push the button on the photocopy machine, because a lot of the early part of the job was that. It helped that I knew some of the continuity. It helped that I was obviously relatively bright, and but there were not stringent qualifications. It was really a personality test, I would say, more than anything.
And who was it that you were working directly with at that time?
My first boss, who was my mentor and became a very good friend, was Mark Grunewald, who unfortunately passed away a number of years ago, about 22, 23 years ago. He passed away suddenly. And he, as I said, he was my mentor. He made sure that while I came in there with a passing knowledge of continuity, one of the books that we worked on was the Official Handbook of the Marvel Universe. Right. So I got a real lesson in all continuity. And Mark was the continuity king of Marvel.
About to say, he was continuity
king,
right?
And so he wanted to make sure that I approached the job in a very thoughtful way. So every day, through conversations with he and I, because we were in the close space, there were lessons for me on, how the structure of story, how to edit, how to interact with creative people, that's what I got from Mark. And I lost my train of thought. But yeah,
I was going to actually ask what it was like to work, because I remember you mentioning you worked with Mark Gruenwald, and for those that are listening, I'm sure you know he's legendary, right? We could say legendary,
oh,
right?
Yes.
Or Squadron.
I will say legendary.
Yeah, Squadron Supreme, which was a classic maxi series, Captain America. Yep. So to work with him so closely is definitely the best mentorship you could get at that time.
Oh, absolutely. And Mark went on to become the executive editor at Marvel Comics, so just below editor-in-chief. And he and Tom DeFalco, who was editor-in-chief, had decided they wanted to have a training program for assistant editors coming up so that everybody would take the job very professionally and be able to look at comics in a very serious way rather than just freewheeling it. And I always say, you know, when I hear what those lessons were like, because I never took part in them officially, but they were all honed on me, you know, because the stuff that he was teaching at the assistant editor classes were stuff that were born out of conversations Mark and I had over the years that I worked for him.
So you could have basically taught that mentorship to other people on that.
Oh, absolutely. And I also think that one of the great things about the Marvel system at that time, and this has gone away for both companies, is because, as I described, we were going to be in a 10 by 10 office together. You'd learn things on the job just by being together. And these days, editors have their own private offices, and their assistants are at potentially the other end of the hall. Well, nobody's teaching anybody anything. You got to figure it out on your own. And, you know, there are some very talented people up there, but I think it's a shame, because I think it's taken away one of the big benefits of that other system. You learn from being close to other people that are doing. Sometimes what you learn is you don't want to do something that somebody else is doing.
Right.
You know, and I think both companies would benefit from a system like that again.
During the 80s were an interesting time, because I feel outside of the people who may have created some of those characters, it's safe to say some of the best stories for the X-Men, Thor, Spider-Man, that was the next best time other than the actual creative people, Stan and Jack and Ditko. What was it like in the 80s being in that bullpen with, the Walter Simonsons and all of the Roger Sterns, all those guys?
Well, it's interesting. We were talking about at the panel yesterday. You know, Stan created this great myth of a bullpen, which was only partially true. Okay, the bullpen definitely did exist, but sometimes more in a metaphorical fashion.
Right.
We did have a large office space in the center, which was where a lot of the production work of putting comic books together. We had people that were doing paste up, and keep in mind, nothing was done digitally back then.
Right.
And then all the editorial offices were around it. But what we had, and we were in New York City, there was a nonstop influx of creators coming in. So, on payday or on the days that the vouchers need to be turned, you'd look up, and at any moment you would see Walt Simonson or Bill Sienkiewicz or John Byrne or Chris Claremont, or you name it, they were there. And that is where I think some of the best story ideas came up, because it was a crucible of creativity.
Right.
We were all there, and everybody was just throwing ideas at each other, and sometimes, you know, for a book you wouldn't work on. Oh, you know what would be really cool? You should do, you know, such and such, and then they would go and turn it into their own. And that because we were all friends too. Most of the names that I just threw out there were all at my wedding when I got married. So we all became friends as well as colleagues, and often co-creators of things. And so it was a great special time that unfortunately doesn't exist. I mean, I think the advent of the internet has not helped us, because now almost everything is done digitally, whether, you know, it's email. I send stuff in, editors read it. Sometimes the artist is in England, and the inker is in L.A., and it just, I don't think it's taken away one of those sparks of creativity,
right? 'Cause
everybody just gets to sit in their office in isolation. And nobody.
Homes.
Well, yeah, yes. Well, home office is what I was thinking.
Right,
yeah. I used to talk to the artists that I worked with all the time. You know, first thing I would do is when I knew I was going to work with a new artist, is I'd pick up the phone and start talking to them. What kind of stuff do you like to draw? What kind of stuff don't you like to draw?
Right.
And I would make sure that I incorporated that into any stories that came
through. Build a relationship with
Absolutely.
That person because you're creating.
Yes. You have to.
And yeah, and as a result, I would say the vast majority of the people that I've worked with in the past, I'm still friends with because we had great relationships.
So, having said that, well, all the friends that you made during that great time, you also had to see the comic book boom and implosion and the start of you know, the images and all the hoopla that came with that. Were you ever tempted to go in on one of those independent or creator-owned lines and leave behind the big two?
Not at the time, because I had a very good contract with Marvel at the time, and so just financially it didn't make sense. And I mean, also honestly, it was not something I was not the kind of artist that Image was creator that Image was looking for. So. That didn't make sense. I am more interested. I think, quite frankly, the creator-owned boom, while it subsided for a while, I think it's given rise. The advent of the internet and digital publishing and self-publishing has made creator-owned projects much more profitable and much more likely these days. I have a couple of creators that I'm working on creator-owned projects for right now. We've got a couple of publishers that are interested in taking a first look at them. And if they don't, we'll do a Kickstarter or we'll self-publish and we'll make some money on it. And then you wind up holding on to more of it than, you know, most of the work I did for Marvel was, all of the work I did for Marvel was work for hire.
Right.
So they own it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do get a little bit of money when they reprint stuff, but it's not a lot. Yeah.
So, I would say out of all of the people who had the task of writing Spider-Man, which is kind of the brass ring at Marvel in a way, to get to that character, it's almost like writing Batman, I guess, the equivalent.
Yeah.
You had the unenviable task to do it at a time where there was a lot of controversy, I guess you could say, following the character. Or even during Heroes Reborn,
uh-huh.
when all the characters were kind of, it was a good jumping on point for a lot of people. Was that refreshing for you to be able to have that task of writing during that time, or did you find it was so much stronger editorial driven?
I assume we're talking about the Clone Saga.
There's the Clone Saga,
right?
And then following the Clone Saga, you stayed on during
right.
that era when they renumbered Spider-Man, correct?
Yes. It was an interesting time, and as I've told this story over and over again, you know, the Clone Saga was never intended to be a saga.
No.
It was a 3-month story arc. I still have the notes.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be in, out, done. Unfortunately, it was a victim of its own success. We started the Clone Saga at the beginning of the implosion, where sales across the board were dropping, except for Spider-Man. And the people in charge decided that the reason Spider-Man sales weren't dropping like a stone, like everything else did, was because of the clone story. So they had us stretch it out, which was a big mistake. And as I said, it became a victim of its own success. And then I was just, I kind of got sucked into it. So even the relaunch afterwards, not a big fan of it. I also was not a big fan of bringing back the Green Goblin. I did not want to do that. In the editorial meeting, and it was editorial, that was the beginning of editorial having a firmer and firmer hand. And when I say editorial, it wasn't just the editor. That's the problem. It went up the chain of command.
Ladder, right?
Yes, and well, it was the editor-in-chief and then the publisher and sales support. Everybody had a say at that point. And that to me was a mistake as well. And I stayed on. I mean, you know, part of it was I had a contract I had to fulfill with them, so I was obligated to write what they asked me to. But as I think I started to say, I was not a big fan of us bringing back the Green Goblin. I thought that was a mistake. I thought it was one of the deaths in the Marvel Universe that should have been permanent and should have just stuck. And I was overruled. And now, having said that, some of the most fun stories I got to write involved Norman Osborn after that. And but it just was not the direction I wanted to go.
So having the experience of working in the office close with the people actually putting the comics out there, it's a hard thing to say no to, but in a character like Spider-Man or even the Batmans or Supermans, I find that it get watered down because they have 4 or 5 titles a month. Would you rather have Spider-Man just be a 2-title character that you get the most rich stories from?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, and that's ultimately what we did. Remember, we went from the 4 titles to the 2 when I was writing both of them. But again, now keeping in mind that I was both a creator and at one point I was an editor and worked for the corporate Marvel, that's a corporate decision. And the reality is, yes, we may think, you know, as creators, the stories get watered down, but corporately, if they're selling, they don't care. They have what they're... As one of them used to say, the bottom line is the bottom line, and they need to make money. Especially once we went from being privately owned to publicly owned, it impacts the stock price and all that. They need to be generating sales, and that's why I often see online criticism of the big crossovers and the renumbering, you know, at number one, and constantly. They would not do that if people didn't buy them.
Right.
And if people buy them, they're going to keep doing it. And people buy them.
You got to vote with the dollar, ultimately.
Yeah, always.
So before we finish up, I got a couple of creator questions for you.
Sure.
So having written Spider-Man, and I've read Spider-Man my whole life, were you a fan of having Peter be a single guy, or did you like the marriage? Because you wrote during while he was married, right?
I think the marriage was a mistake, ultimately.
Okay.
I came in after that. And it was one of the things that, you know, creatively we all spoke about. It was that we understood why, you know, there was a progression of a character and a progression of a relationship. And so the natural progression would lead to a marriage or them splitting up.
Right.
But they went with the marriage because, again... sales boost.
Right.
And it was hamstringing the stories. And if you look at it as, you know, Peter Parker, what made, and we spoke about this over and over again at editorial meetings or creative meeting writers conferences, what was it that made Peter Parker appealing in the beginning? He was a young kid who was down on his luck, you know, was always struggling. He was the everyman.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, by the time I came on, he was married to a supermodel, and he had a regular job, and they had this fantastic penthouse apartment. So that whole element of the everyman went away, unless the everyman was... what we now are referring to as the 1%.
Right.
Peter became the 1%. And that, you know, and out of that, we had lots and lots of conversations. How can you get back to that?
Right.
Divorce seemed the wrong way to go because divorce immediately... That was the other thing. The marriage aged him. And our characters have been around forever. You want to give the illusion of them being young.
Yeah.
And divorce... immediately ages him even more than the marriage, and that's where the Clone Saga was born. We thought, and was Terry Cavanaugh came up with the idea. He pitched it to me first, and I said, "Well, you know, that's interesting. Let's pitch it to the rest of the team." And we did, and we met a lot of resistance at first, and then the writers got on board, and we were able to get the editors on board as well. But the ultimate goal was for us to have a single Peter Parker who
had that freedom to
and we weren't going to have a divorce.
Right.
So, you know, why not go that way?
Right. Okay. So one last question before we wrap up. I asked this question to Jerry Conway, and I like asking Spider-Man writers this because I feel there's two characters in the comic universe who have the two best rogues gallery, and I like to debate So what's your choice? Is it Spider-Man's Rogues Gallery or Batman, who has a superior Rogues Gallery?
Oh, that's tough.
I would argue Spider-Man's for the fact that you don't really know who is his Joker.
Right. Oh, no, I agree. And, you know, as soon as you say, Batman's Rogues Gallery, you immediately just go to the Joker, and it's one. I mean, some people will say Venom is Spider-Man's, you know, antithesis.
Right.
I mean, and certainly was the reason he was created. I mean, he's basically a negative Spider-Man. I love Batman. I got to write one Batman story and was thrilled to do it, incredibly intimidated by it after having written, you know, many, many, many stories featuring Spider-Man. But I am such a fan of that early run of Spider-Man. It just blew me away in what Stan did, and it was something I tried to reflect when I did Ghost Rider. If you think about it, if you look at the first 12 issues of Spider-Man, he introduced all those characters.
Yeah.
He introduced, you know, Electro and, Sandman and all of them.
Everybody's there, the Vulture, yeah.
Yeah, 12 issues. And that's what I tried to do in my first 12 issues of Ghost Rider before it took off, on its own and everybody wanted to write Ghost Rider. So I would have to lean towards Spider-Man because most of those characters have been around forever, and so there were far more. And with Batman, it was the Joker, and then much later on, we got other characters.
You got the Ra's al Ghul.
Yes, yeah, exactly, and Bane, and you know all that. So I'm going Team Spider-Man on this
all
one.
Right, it's a tie. Jerry Conway said Batman, which I was surprised because he's made such an impact on Spider-Man, but I'm happy to see that Spider-Man gets
good.
A victory.
Heck with Jerry.
Thank you so much for your time. I hope you enjoy the rest of your time at the con and in Toronto. Thank you for coming to Toronto. I'm going to go check out the two Howards at the next panel.
Great.
Thank you.
Yeah, hopefully it doesn't explode.
We are closing out the day at Comic-Con 2018 with the Cave of Solitude fan favorite guest, the one and only Mike Ruth. He's here at his table drawing right now for a little guy, a Ghost Rider. Mike, how's it going? How's the show been for you?
It's going awesome, man. It's been a great show. Toronto's always kind to me.
That's awesome. So yesterday you had a great sketch duel. You want to tell everybody what you were requested to sketch and how you you finished it off?
Well, there was a little bit of debate on as to what we were going to draw, and we eventually all decided on She-Hulk. And She-Hulk as Rosie the Riveter, I think, is what was finally decided. I didn't draw that. I just drew She-Hulk lifting up a little dumbbell. And it was kind of fun. Those sketch duels are always fun, though. The great fan response and just, people are awesome.
Have you kept a track of ones that you've considered that you've won and ones that you maybe, it was a draw or a tie?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I like the idea of winners and losers on these, but because the fans ultimately decide.
That's right.
Yesterday, I can't really claim a fair victory because the guy that won the draw happened to be a friend of mine. So he picked my piece naturally, you know.
I would have done the same.
Yeah. Cheers.
So I guess it's kind of the scales are tipped a little bit, but that's okay. We got to root for our hometown hero, right?
Yeah, exactly, man. No, I always get treated so well in this city, so it's always a pleasure to come for sure, man.
So can we officially talk about the project that you're working on?
Yeah,
is it safe?
I can talk a little bit about it.
A little bit about it. Okay.
A few things I can't say, but what I can say is that it's a story written by Matt Nixon, who I think. Retcon is his series from Image, and that wrapped up in December, and I'm actually doing the prequel to that story. That's going to be fun. I'm not far enough along in the project that I can say when it's going to be released or what's going to happen with that, but it is coming, and it's in the process right now. I'm drawing the first issue, and I'm super excited. It's been a long time coming. This has been something I've kind of waited for my whole life, and I guess Matt saw something in my work that he wanted, he wanted to tell his story. He wanted to continue the adventures of the Retcon guys and maybe give a little bit of foundational origin stuff on some of the characters that were introduced in the retcon series. So this series that I'm drawing is called Dodge, and it's about the main character whose name is Chris the Animal Dodge. In retcon, he is a guy with special abilities. He's like a special forces soldier kind of guy who's got some special abilities. In retcon, he was able to turn into a bear. And he's kind of like this super lethal, powerful soldier, basically. He's got a great sense of humor, and the comic is just kind of fun to draw. It's lots of cool stuff. Dodge is going to feature some really great villains and some characters that also appeared in retcon, Lieutenant Swan and Arnold Begay. And it kind of feels to me like from the script, it feels a bit like a G.I. Joe meets Hellboy kind of story. You know, there's special soldiers that they face extra worldly stuff. So it's pretty exciting, man. He had me at the word werebear. I was signed on. So.
So had you been familiar with the series retcon before?
I'll be honest with you, man. I hadn't heard of Matt before this. It was actually my friends at Aftershock that contacted me about it. They said that a writer had reached out to them about finding an artist for a book, and he really liked my stuff and wanted to hire me. And from what I understand, he called to ask basically permission to hire me, and Aftershock said, well, you know, Mike's a freelancer with us, but go ahead and give him a call. And so I guess Matt just saw something in my work that he thought would be perfect for the book, and then once I read the pitch, I was like, yep, that sounds like something I would draw. So I had really debated it, because over the years I've received lots of scripts in my inbox that I haven't been able to address because I have a full-time job, or I had a full-time job as a superintendent. And it makes it difficult to commit to any kind of projects that are bigger than a cover or a pinup or a small short story. The idea of signing on to do an actual monthly comic book is just too crazy an idea. And so it never really crossed my mind as an option. But, you know, I'm in my early 40s now. And as my mom would say, you know, it's time to shit or get off the pot. You know what I mean? So it's one of these things where I'm taking the opportunity because I don't know if I'm going to get an opportunity like this again. And I feel like I'm ready for it, but it's meant that I've had to make some big changes in my life. I actually resigned from my position as superintendent to open up my time full time so that I can literally just wake up in the morning and draw this comic book. So I'm pretty excited about it, but I'm also, if I'm completely honest, totally terrified, because it's a lot of pressure to do a monthly book. And it's not a pressure I felt in a while, but it's going to be a little bit better when I actually get to leave my job. My resignation kind of went sideways when the guy who was replacing me quit after an hour in his first shift. So I, as a good-natured man, I have stepped up basically to assist with the building while they find another replacement for me. But it's really it's really slowed me down. I really wanted to be further ahead on this first issue than I am. But, you know, I'm going to get there, man. It's all I think about, you know. I actually almost didn't come to the show this weekend because I really wanted to get ahead on my pages. But Matt encouraged me to come and do the show and, you know, connect with the people about it and do a little bit of talking about it. So I'd recommend if anyone can go to their local comic shop and go in the back bins or wherever, maybe it's still on the shelf, and try to find retcon. I'm not sure if it's being collected in a trade. It's a four-issue series, so I imagine it will be. It's a fantastic story, and the artist of that was Toby Cypress, who's amazing. And I wasn't really familiar with his work until I read retcon, and now I have to kind of follow what he did, and I don't think anyone can follow that guy. So I'm kind of just taking a totally different approach, because our styles couldn't be more different. But the story that I'm telling is much different than the retcon story, so it's just in that world. So, yeah. Here you go, sir.
Thank you.
He just finished the Ghost Rider, and it is awesome. Very nice. That was quick, and it was great.
Thanks, man.
So, when you have a guy who approaches you and says, "I saw your work, and I think you would be right for the book I want to put together," doesn't that give you a little bit of a bolster of confidence to know that that person sees what you do?
Yeah. You know, the thing about confidence with an artist, most of the artists I know, is it's usually confidence that's found from the people that love you and support you. Like, everyone believes in me in this job. I need to convince myself that I can do this. It's one of those things where I got everyone going, "Oh, dude, you're going to rock. This is right up your alley. You're going to love it." And I'm really being tested by some of the things I have to draw on this book. But it's a good test. It's a healthy test. And I'm excited about the challenge. Yeah, it's a big compliment when someone reaches out like specifically and says, "I want you to draw this book." Especially a guy like with Matt Nixon, who's done some pretty big stuff. I mean, he worked on Wolverine and some other things like that. So, but I have to admit, I wasn't familiar with him until he contacted me. So that was kind of nice. So I've actually never met him in person. We haven't spoken on the phone. We've just had an online emails, and it's been awesome. He's just a super supportive guy. So I'm really excited to be working with him.
So. You seem to be the type of guy, I mean, we all know that you can draw, and you can draw some kick-ass stuff, right? That's unquestionable. But do you have sort of a, because we often talk about the pressure that you have, or the fear of not, getting it done, so you have said no to scripts, because you never want to let people down, because you've got a full-time job. Do you feel that there's a fear of success or a fear of failure? Because sometimes I think people... We say we're scared of the failure, but sometimes we also may not know how we'll handle it, the success of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think fear of failure is literally the energy that flows through my battery. I feel like that has been a guide in my life in so many things, like fear like the fear of that I'm going to suck at it, the fear that I'm going to be torn apart by critics, the fear that I'm going to be reviewed into oblivion, mainly because people like my covers and stuff, but they haven't really seen my sequential stuff too much. And I've only done a little bit of stuff for Captain Canuck and different things for Chapter House. But this is a big challenge for me. So I'm friends with so many comic book artists and so many great creators and at different levels that it really... It is daunting. I mean, there's guys who are cranking out comics book every month, or they're staying on track with all of their stuff, and they're, I don't know, it's hard to, it feels like a lot of pressure because everyone makes it look easy. I think, and I know it's not easy. I know everyone struggles with this stuff, but there's a lot of anxiety and pressure that comes with a job like this, especially now that it's real. I mean, I've been working on my own comic, Widow's Wake, for years, but it hasn't happened because I haven't really had the push or the paycheck, behind it. It was all self-driven. So this is different because this is me. This is me. I just lost my train of thought.
This is you working, I guess, off of a script.
Sorry, say again.
You're working off of someone's script.
I'm working off of a script. So it's been great. And he gave me some descriptions of the characters, and the story that I'm drawing takes place in a different era than retcon, so the clothing is a bit different, and some different things, different military stuff, and the script is great, it's funny, it's got some great action, there's a couple of splash page fight scenes that he's written that are just genius, and
That's right up your alley, right?
Yeah, I love that. I love that kind of fight choreography aspect of drawing a comic book. I probably spend too much time plotting that stuff out. But there's this great scene where the character takes down three guys with machine guns barehanded, and it's just a pretty fun couple of pages to draw. So yeah, it's exciting.
How detailed are his scripts? Has he given you a lot of freedom to kind of control the timing of what you get to do on the page, or is he very specific of, I need it to look like this? Does he have a good understanding of what the artist can do?
Yeah, I think he knows my strengths, because he's written stuff that maybe he knows my strengths, and maybe he's recognized, maybe he hasn't seen some of my weaknesses yet. But the story, it's a lot of outside. It's in the snow, it's in the jungle. There's lots of exterior shots. There's not so much interior stuff. There's not a whole lot of, in the first issue anyway, there's just a lot of fighting outside and lots of trees and vines and all that stuff that I like to draw. So and the details in the script are great. He'll tell me okay, this is going to be six panels on this page, and he'll tell me what he wants in each panel. But it's really, there's lots of room to interpret, I think,
It's the voice of God, as Martin likes to say. So, can you give us, for Retcon, this particular miniseries that follows Dodge, can you give us an elevator pitch of what the story synopsis is without giving anything away, or is those some of the things you can't tell us?
I'm not sure how much I can say, but I can say it's going to be a high-action kind of piece. It's, if you could imagine... if you can imagine taking your three favorite G.I. Joes and putting them in a mission against you know, otherworldly things. I mean, you can imagine the kind of fun you can have with that sort of a scenario.
Did you read G.I. Joe comics growing up, like the Larry Hammer?
Yeah, I love the G.I. Joe comics, man. I love the whole G.I. Joe thing, the cartoon, the toys. I mean, that was my life. Actually, it's funny. I'm a big wrestling guy, as you know.
Yeah.
And when we were kids, of course, the wrestling toys we had were these big rubber, immovable statues. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And when I was a kid, my whole wrestling league, I had like a miniature ring, and I made miniature belts by hand with like, you know, a paintbrush and a pen, and I'd cut them out and make little plates for the belts. And my G.I. Joes were my wrestling league. Like my, you know, Firefly was my world champ, and Outback was the Intercontinental champ, and yeah, you know, yeah, my tag team were the you know, the Tomax and Zaymot. You know what I mean? Like I just, they were poseable and it was fun, and I had a ring to their scale. So I probably spent too much time playing with G.I. Joe wrestlers.
So now you get to have the G.I. Joe aspect of a story.
Yeah.
But everyone also knows that you draw one of the best Swamp Things out there. So you have, you're combining both. Like, that's...
Yeah, I mean, this book, I mean, when he pitched it to me, I don't know if I can say the elevator pitch without revealing too much, but yeah, it's basically kind of like a... It feels like kind of like a Jason Bourne movie, or like a Rambo movie, where you've got this kind of one-man army kind of thing happening, and the enemies are, you know, supernatural, and... Yeah, man, it's just great. He's just he's this dude who wears a Black Sabbath T-shirt and carries a machine gun, and he's just a big bruiser of a guy, and he's funny. And
did you give him a big red beard?
I don't know if he's got red hair. I think he's in Retcon he had blonde hair, and this one. Okay.
We could tweak it.
Yeah, it can. Yeah, you know what? This is interesting. This project is interesting because I'm not coloring it. Another colorist is doing it. I'm not sure who the colorist is yet. And that's always a curious game to play, too, because I've always been in control of how the final image will look. And this is a situation where I won't be in control of that. And it'll just be a matter of, getting the drawings to a point where I can just let them go and let the colorist do his magic. I'm going to probably have to tweak my style a little bit for my interiors because I'm not sure if every colorist knows what to do with ink washes. Sometimes they can get very muddy.
Yep.
Sometimes flesh tones and things like that get really darkened up in a comic book with washes. But there's guys out there who know how to color hold and paint into those frames and do some interesting thing with the existing tones. So I don't know who the colorist is yet, but I'm kind of curious to see what he can do with a few of my... I've done a few pinups for Dodge that are finished drawings that we're going to send to him and see what he can do with them. Because I'd love to do the whole book like how I normally ink stuff. Now it will be a bigger time demand. But I may just have to actually tweak my style to something that's more black and white, so I can. It's easier for the colorist, and it's a little, maybe a little bit faster for me.
Yeah, you gotta give yourself something, you know.
I mean, I can, you know me, I can sit and noodle on a drawing for a week, but in comics you don't have that luxury.
Yeah.
I gotta have that pencil page that page penciled by 5 p.m. so I can ink all night, kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's I can't wait for the day when it finally comes, when I can wake up in the morning and know that superintendent job is behind me, and I can just wake up in the morning at 8 when my wife goes to work, and I just draw and just.
You just gotta drop those keys, Mike. You just gotta drop them and just say. That's
yeah,
it.
That's what it is, man. And you know, I'm only doing it because like I said, I'm a nice guy, and I think sometimes nice people use someone's niceness against them to hurt them. In my case, I'm sympathetic to my employers not being able to find someone to replace me, and I'm just trying to maintain the peace at our building. But yeah, it's a shitty spot to be in, man. I'll be honest with you. I just wanted to wake up on March 1st and draw comics, and here I am on March. What, 17th?
18th.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, I'm not as far ahead on the project as I'd like to be as a result of the albatross that's still hanging around my neck. But soon, hopefully soon. And you're right, eventually it's just going to be, here's your keys, piss off. I got a comic to draw. You know, so that's kind of what it's coming to. I just don't have that within me. I'm not mean like Martin here. I can't just...
Hi, Martin.
I can't just get nasty.
How you doing, guys?
I can't just get nasty and drop...
Pop bomb.
Throw axe at people's. You know, I can't just be pulling out the... I can't just pull out the axe and start chopping, you know?
We'll send Martin and Shane over to deal with them.
I need him to chop some people up for me and, you know...
Gotcha.
Well, we're looking forward to the book. We know it's going to be great. Don't doubt yourself, because everybody's cheering for you. And we look forward to the splash pages of action, but those storytelling details, you don't kill yourself.
No.
We want the comic to come out. We want Mike Ruth's name on a comic book.
Well, I appreciate the support, because, you know, it's like I said, it's like finding that confidence within. Everyone believes in me but me right now. I just gotta get there. I'm getting there. I just some of the material I'm drawing is unfamiliar to me.
Yeah.
And I'm not a technical draftsman. I'm an illustrator. So I have to just find the. I have to find that streamlined thing. You know.
Cheat a little bit. Put a handle on. Someone's hand on the gun handle. Just hide that stuff.
I really want to do this book old school and draw everything, but I'm at the point where I'm almost considering doing some of the penciling digitally, just so I can get in close and make sure some of those more technical things look right, and then I can ink them however. But to me, I can't just like silhouette something and drop highlights. I've got to understand how it works. I have to understand how it's built so that I can draw it from different angles and feel confident.
Right.
And that can take time. So
yeah.
I can't lose too much time doing that stuff.
You don't want to lose too much time doing that stuff. So when after this project you get to Marvel 2-in-1 and you're drawing the thing, don't forget about me and Martin, okay?
I won't forget about you guys. But one thing I want to especially let Martin know, I've already been contacted, not by anyone big in terms of the big company, but I have retailers who've already said Conan's coming back to Marvel. Would you be interested in doing some Conan stuff for our store, or doing a cover for our store, or doing this? And I mean, they didn't even have to ask. I'm already tingling at the notion that I'd get to draw anything for Conan in any capacity in the future. But I don't want to say that. I don't want to jinx myself. But I've already had people reach out and say, "Hey, man, Conan 2019. What do you think?"
Yeah, it's gonna happen.
I'm Jack, man. We'll see.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Always a pleasure, man.
Martin, thank you for the pod bomb.
You're welcome. Anytime.
We will talk to everybody soon.